by way of, I guess, very, very brief background, ECCS, we're a comprehensive mobile laboratory provider based in Wisconsin, and we have been supporting the subject of this presentation almost continually since its inception in 1995. To date, we've supported over 400 projects of this nature and are very excited to get this case study, the exposure it has received within the Triad community, in large part because it is a Wisconsin-based success story. You see and read and hear a lot of success stories coming from the West and the East Coast, but I guess we're proud to show a little bit of the heartland in terms of an environmental success story. So with that, I'll direct you to slide number 2, which is the presentation overview, just to give you a flavor for what we're going to cover. And for those of you who are not aware, that is the state of Wisconsin. There should be a piece of cheese there. The presentation, I will cover the objectives of the presentation. I will then talk about the DATCAP program, its history and the overview. As well as the typical site layout for this programmatic multi-site case study that we'll be exploring today. And most importantly, throughout this whole programmatic approach, I will try to demonstrate the full use of the Triad toolbox, if you would, that being the systematic planning aspects and the conceptual site model, the dynamic work strategy that is used, and the real-time measurement techniques that are used throughout this process. And then I will come with some conclusions. Gene, don't hesitate to stop me if a question does come in. I guess I won't be sidetracked if a question does come in. So, you know, please feel free to ask them during the presentation versus waiting to the end. It doesn't matter to me. So with that, we'll go to slide 3, and I guess then very quickly to slide 4 to talk about the objectives of today's presentation. In highlighting this programmatic application of Triad, I guess I also found an opportunity to explore many of the somewhat discussed and prevalent Triad myths that you have maybe read about on Triad Central or within the Triad community. And so in addition to talking about this statewide programmatic approach, I will try to demonstrate that, number one, simply using a mobile laboratory does not in and of itself make a Triad project. Here we are, a mobile laboratory provider, but we have seen many, many, many good applications and uses of a mobile lab integrated into the Triad approach. But simply using a mobile lab doesn't make a successful project or a successful Triad project. Another objective will be to show the Triad approach can be used on small sites, and these sites in question are, in fact, very small, and we'll look at those sites in a little bit, in a few slides. We're going to try to demonstrate a programmatic application of Triad. So many of the case studies that we hear about are for a very specific site. This is a different look at it programmatically. How Triad techniques extend into remedial action. For those who maybe attended day 3 and for those who didn't, I was lucky enough to moderate that session, and that was Triad's use during remedial design, remedial action. Triad's often thought about as being an investigative tool, but I guess this is a case study, another case study of which we're able to demonstrate Triad's use during remedial action. And then last, the Triad project that never uses the term Triad, i.e. the Triad chicken and the egg debate, which is maybe something I kind of have coined. You know, the concept of when is a Triad project a Triad project. This program in question started basically as early as the 1980s and really got legs in 1994. prior to the formal development and branding of the True Triad approach. But again, as I discussed a little bit earlier, I will try to show all aspects of the Triad Toolbox, and therefore maybe one more application of a good Triad program that never uses the word Triad in any of the documents. Slide 5. One of the key elements of this case study is, of course, the term programmatic implementation, and the program in question is DATCAP, which will take us to slide 6. DATCAP, the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, is a standalone department within the state of Wisconsin. It parallels the Department of Natural Resources, and is a very multifaceted department that has roles and responsibilities with a lot of aspects, in particular with the Department of Ag, since Wisconsin is a very agricultural dependent state. Trade and consumer protection. It has programs such as the household hazardous waste cleanup, etc. It works in parallel with the Department of Natural Resources. But in this case, we're focusing on ag chem sites, agricultural chemical, fertilizer, pesticide sites. And the program in question is the ACCP, the Agricultural Chemical Cleanup Program, established in 1994. And it was established to identify and help manage the cleanup of releases of pesticide and fertilizer spills throughout the hundreds of sites that dot Wisconsin. Once a site has been identified as needing a cleanup, the ACCP program provides reimbursement for eligible costs incurred by the responsible persons. This is very unique throughout the nation, and one of only a small handful that have a reimbursement program based on a taxation of the pesticides that are used. And it's very much like what is more commonly understood in the underground storage tank program realm of things, where PRPs would enroll their site for eligible reimbursement, and reimbursement is everything that's in the program less about a $3,000 to $7,500 copay, depending on if it's an individually owned co-op or if it's a dealership. So with that, we'll move to slide 7 and begin talking about the DATCAP program and its history. And this history is very important because ultimately what it's going to lead to is the development of, I guess, what we'll call a programmatic conceptual site model. But the problem statement dates back to 1984, when the DATCAP, in conjunction with the DNR, discovered approximately 30 cases of soil and groundwater contamination at or near sites where pesticides were mixed and loaded. They commenced a study over that four-year period of investigative, both soil and groundwater, and in 1989, they completed a report summarizing the findings. And the findings, due to the frequency, which is virtually every site they looked at, and the severity in terms of the concentrations of pesticides and fertilizer detected in both soil and in groundwater, necessitated a call for a statewide action plan. At that time, there was a formal stakeholder group that was formed, multi-agency, or I should say multi-department, as well as outside support, and they conducted even further investigation, culminating in a 1991 report, which was the findings that basically formed the essence of the programmatic conceptual site model. Both of those documents, the 89 and the 1991 studies are available And at the end of the slide, I'll give you a resource on how to get to those. They are very good resources across the country for those conducting due diligence or investigations, regardless of which program they're in, at similar sites, which we'll talk about. Based on that 1991 study findings, over the course of a few years, and culminating in 1994, the ACCP was established. The Agricultural Chemical Cleanup Program, reimbursement program, was established. And from that point to today, based on, you know, even the website, as we sit here today, the ACCP has initiated over 509 facility-related cleanups within the state and have closed out cradle to grave, over half of those. They've also, in addition to more facility-wide cleanups, they've responded to and closed out, over 97% of the 874 reported spills. And I guess most importantly, have had, received, 950 reimbursement applications and have paid out over $33 million in reimbursements. So with that, we'll go to slide 8, typical site layout. Talk about the sites in question. And that will take us to slide 9, which you are looking, I guess purposely attained using Google Street View, because you've passed them, I would venture to guess, either in your daily life and daily commutes, or certainly in your vacations. They're throughout the country, from west to east, as well as here in the heartland. This is a very typical pesticide dealership or cooperative or agronomy site that are all over the country. Taking us to slide 10, we have an aerial view. And I guess a few important but quick notes about these sites. Number one, as I indicated in the beginning, these are very small sites. These aren't large complexes of tens to hundreds of acres. These are typically small dealerships in rural communities dotted by residents, small in size, 2 to 10 acres, I would put on average. Primarily, the primary migration pathway, at least in Wisconsin, what was found statewide, in part necessitating that call for action, was that these sites are located in permeable to highly permeable soil geology, where, in addition, groundwater is used for both industrial as well as for drinking water purposes. So that takes us to slide 11 to kind of talk a little bit about the release pathways of these sites that have been operating for years and years. One of the primary contaminant migration pathways are the bulk liquid mixing and loading areas. These are where the trucks, whether it be farmer or whether it be commercial transport, come in, pesticides are mixed and loaded for off-site shipment. It takes it to the bulk liquid pesticide and nitrogen storage areas. These sites are typically relatively flat, but drainage ways and ponding areas do form, causing preferential pathways for releases and spills that occur over time. Pesticide equipment parking areas typically, in many cases, are not paved. You've got pesticide equipment, vehicle weigh scale pits. You have acute spill areas, container storage areas, burn piles, dry fertilizer load-in and load-out areas, which pose, you know, in some cases less challenge, but in some cases more challenges than the liquids, and then the wash areas. Basically, you have a relatively defined and consistent across site-to-site areas of which were part of that initial conceptual site model development to evaluate, investigate, and model the pathways, contaminants of concern, and basically what is the baseline conceptual site model at any one of these dealerships. Takes us to slide 12. We have systematic planning and conceptual site models. One of the first leg of the triad approach, taking us to slide 13. Systematic planning, the first and important element. Framing the problem, identifying the project objectives, constraints, stakeholders, the regulatory framework, and primary and secondary decisions that need to be made. All of this was done very comprehensively, as I mentioned, dating back to 1984 through 1991, and then with the culmination of the development of the ACCP program in 1994. Multiple stakeholders, including the constituents themselves, again, ranging from small individual cooperatives owned by one or a handful of members to the larger companies that have over the years bought up a lot of the individual cooperatives. But the problem was well framed, and again, those documents that I mentioned frame it very well. Developing the conceptual site model. Those reports in particular developed the baseline conceptual site model, which formed the basis of the program going forward. And then, I guess most importantly, from going from new site to new site, evaluating and managing uncertainty. While these sites have a lot of similarities, there are obviously going to be unique features as well as a baseline understanding that have to be evaluated and managed throughout the life of the project once it's enrolled. So with that, we'll go to slide 14. And the conceptual site model synthesizes and crystallizes what is already known about a site that is pertinent to decision-making requirements. It takes on several formats, and with the host of clients that we have worked with, we have seen those multiple different formats being graphical, being tabular, being a wide range of tools that they use depending on their experience within the program and the technology that's available to them and the complexity of the certain site. That CSM, which again, the baseline is well documented, going into each unique site, we've seen a wide range of formats. That takes us to slide 15. And this is kind of the important input to the statewide strategy dating back in time. And what they found was that between 86 and 99% of all the sites in Wisconsin can be expected to be contaminated. Again, necessitating that action plan, that programmatic action plan. Between 45 and 75% will require soil remediation to address the migration to groundwater pathway. Certainly a smaller number have ultimately contamination exceeding cleanup levels, but there certainly are several of them that also require groundwater to be addressed. Several common site areas will be targeted. Discussed those a little bit earlier. Sites are sampled and entered into the program. It's even in some cases a little bit more than simply voluntary. There are high priority, medium and low priority sites, and once the site is in the program, they have to, then go through the process, and again, they can get reimbursement for going through that process, but it certainly is, I would call it a little, in my own opinion, a little bit more than simply voluntary. There is active oversight. Budgets and time frame are essential. Need for use of a dynamic approach across the board. And that takes us to slide 16. I guess the very important dynamic work strategies that are used. Taking us to slide 17. Dynamic work strategy is very important for these sites. In part, they need to fill data gaps that are present between the programmatic CSM and unique site-specific conditions. Whether it's a recent spill or older historical spills over time, whether it's below buildings or in open areas, drainage ways. Those data gaps need to be filled, and operations, containment structures available, geology, hydrogeology all come into play. More importantly, a dynamic work strategy is needed to address these activities during a very short window. Wisconsin obviously is dependent upon its agricultural program, the farming community, and these cooperatives are critical components of that. So they can't have long ongoing either investigation activities or remediation activities. So we talk about these very short windows in the spring, in those time just after the snow melts, you know, before the cooperatives and dealerships are busy, and in the fall after farming is you know basically complete, the crops are down. You know, then they can address the cleanup in those couple of week period between fall and winter that we commonly see in the state of Wisconsin. Taking us to slide 18, and I guess a couple of keys to you know what I believe are the program's success in terms of implementing these dynamic work strategies. Starting with the well-documented baseline CSM, you know, I guess I killed that one to tell you how well-documented it is, but that has been critical to this program's success. Understanding site-specific nuances and uncertainty, and while there are so many similarities, I don't think anything is treated as true cookie-cutter. Not being rigid and allowing the CSM to mature real-time, in part, that's necessitated because of the dynamic nature and the windows of opportunity that the program allows. Experienced field staff and I say both consultants and agency. You know, there's the ACCP program is a very small group of experienced practitioners with a lot of longevity within this program, as well as the consultants. You know, we've only seen a very small number over the last decade and or so that you know basically have grown up on this program and continue to work within this program successfully, both to in terms of their client base as well as working with the agency. There's very few you know new players that come in. Although there certainly are, you know, a few of them, it's certainly not an elite group, if you would. But that experienced field staff is very critical. Large universe of sites in the hundreds. You know, the fact that there's been so many going through this program has made it a success. Informed stakeholder group at all levels. Very involved. The small cooperatives or the larger corporations, all very, very hands-on, if you would, and that's both of, that's pun intended, because you know this is their livelihood, so they're often very, very involved with the investigative and cleanup activities, and then the dynamic work strategy is used throughout the process. Up to and including site closure. It doesn't stop at the investigation, but it continues on through site closure. And with that, we'll take us to slide 19, real-time measurements.
Actually, Nick, this is Jean. I'm going to stop you. There are some questions that came in the room here that wanted to know a little bit more about the CSMs. They wanted to know if the CSMs you were working with were more advanced, sort of developed with computer programs, maybe like a three-dimensional groundwater flow model. And if so, have you or were you able to document the benefits of putting forth that effort and developing a more robust CSM in the process?
That's a great question, and now I do see it. I guess I will give you, you know, my perspective, our perspective, ECCS's perspective. We're the mobile laboratory provider. And so in projects that we're involved with, we're providing in inputs to our clients, the consultants and engineers, to develop their CSMs. So we personally have not been, I guess, the first party in terms of developing the CSM. We work very closely with them, and we have seen multiple different formats. Although I will tell you from my own opinion that due to the nature of these sites, and by all means I'm not going to call them simple, I have not seen too many very complex 3D models, you know, using some of the sophisticated programs that are available today. I have not seen them firsthand. I'm not saying that they're not used. Because the baseline CSM for these has so well documented migration pathways, a lot of these are in similar geology, hydrogeology regimes, that I just haven't personally have any experience, you know, firsthand to see, you know, the some of the more sophisticated 3D models that have been used. And if you know, there's further questions with regards to that, I guess I would be happy to put you in contact with some of those clients that we have worked with on these types of sites to get their input, their firsthand input.
Okay, great. Thank you. I think that got the question. Thanks.
Okay, so with that, we'll go to slide 19, real-time measurement, the third leg of the triad approach, and I guess the one that we're, you know, ECCS is most involved with. You know, in terms of the investigation, most of these are direct push drilling techniques that are used, and during the remedial action, and in some cases also during the investigation concurrent with the geoprobe investigation, test pits are used quite frequently at these sites because they render, you know, very, very good samples that can be used either during the investigation or to help refine the investigation during the remediation. Mobile laboratory is used for 75% of the sites in either the investigation and or, in some cases both, or the remediation. So in either one or the other, a large percentage of these use the mobile laboratory for two reasons. Number one, just from the sheer power of being able to make the infield decisions in a very short window in one mobilization, as well as the cost, is in many cases very comparable to using a fixed base laboratory, even using a standard turnaround time because of the cost of the test, in particular the pesticide testing. And as a side note, with the pesticide testing by 8141 GCMPD, you know, in terms of a demonstration of method applicability, you know, we were involved dating back to the inception of the program, working with the VATCAP program, understanding what the contaminants of concern were, and very early on, a short list of pesticides was developed. And then we worked with the program to develop a test method that was very rigorous, very mobile, and provided very high-quality defensible data with regards to those pesticides. So at most of the sites, pesticides, a list of 17 well-published pesticides are evaluated and analyzed for, as well as for the fertilizer components of nitrate, and ammonia, which in most cases we do by ion selective electrode, using some standard methods that we have developed as a baseline. Cost, just looking at it from a cost perspective, 25 pesticides, 25 nitrogen can be analyzed for about $1,800 a day. With the results for the pesticides, it's a GC method that we have developed. Results can be within about an hour and they have a definitive pesticide result, and even quicker for the nitrogen and ammonia. And with that, I guess I'll kind of tie things up here, moving quickly to slide 22. And basically, hopefully, I've at least met some of the objectives. I hope to demonstrate that simply using a mobile laboratory does not make a triad project, that there are certainly all aspects of the triad toolbox that need to be employed in order for it to be successful from that perspective. The triad approach can be used on small sites. Again, these are in the small number of acreages, but they've been used very successfully, and the cost effectiveness of the approach has substantiated itself in a state reimbursement program for well over a decade. How triad techniques extend into remedial action. That conceptual site model is taken into the remedial action. And in some cases, there is some additional investigation that's done concurrent with the excavation contractor, digging portions that are more well-defined. So that CSM is never stopping, as well as the different techniques used to provide real-time measurement. And then lastly, a triad project that never uses the term triad. But this is, certainly, I guess, what we believe is a very good application of it. I provide contact information there for myself if there's any questions for ECCS. I do have the contact information for Jason Lowry, who's one of the project managers. He's a hydrogeologist at the ACCP in Wisconsin. So if you want to contact the agency directly, Jason will gladly help you or direct you to someone within his group that can. And then the studies that I have spoken about are definitely available in hard copy. And so if you email me or Jason, because I'll route it through the department if I get it. If you want to get copies of those, again, they're very applicable nationwide in terms of these types of sites, which have many similarities even across the country. And with that, are you aware of other state programs adopting the TRIDE approach? That's a very good point, because Wisconsin is by all means not unique. I wanted to mention Minnesota. Their Department of Ag has a very similar program. And, again, it's the similar types of sites, and it's a similar program. It's a reimbursement program, well documented on the Minnesota Department of Ag, in terms of what they're doing and how they're doing it. So there's a lot of similarities there. There have been some smaller applications, less programmatic in other states in terms of having some reimbursement, but I haven't seen too many, at least in the greater Midwest, Region 5, Region 7 areas of where it's been such a statewide, very aggressive program. Then there's a question here. Do you find more private clients are willing to adopt triad practices now that state organization programs are using this? And, that question could be asked for a lot of people on this phone call. Certainly in my opinion, the agency, federal EPA, has put a lot of time and energy in providing the resources, but it certainly is a very important aspect to get state agency buy-in, training, and support for the triad movement. And I have seen numerous cases throughout the country because ECCS, basically we've been to most states east of the Rockies, of where there has been state buy-in and state activity in the triad movement, there have been more, you know, I guess what I would call true triad projects, or at least triad projects that use the term triad. So with that,
it's just a reminder, those of you on the phone lines, if you want to just vocally ask a question, if you've muted your line, simply hit #6 to unmute, and you can actually speak up and ask a question directly to Nick.
Or if you're in Kansas, you can come to the KDHE conference here in Wichita, Kansas.
Okay, I think, again, if you do have any follow-up questions or something pops into your mind later on, you can go ahead and either submit them electronically online, or we will have more time later on in the session to actually interact with Nick and have those questions answered. So thank you, Nick. I appreciate it. And I think if I could direct everybody to move on to slide number 23, which is the starting slide for our second presentation today. That's going to be delivered by Sharon from CDM, where we'll look at effective funding management approaches for triad investigations. Sharon, are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Great, thank you.
Okay, so slide 23. I'm Sharon Budney. I work with CDM Federal Programs, and I'm located in our Edison, New Jersey office today. We're going to talk about a project. This is kind of a case study for the Emerald Septic Landfill site. So we'll go to slide number 24. And what I hope to present today is a project summary of the Emerald Septic Landfill remedial investigation, the incremental funding challenges that we faced through the project, triad investigations implemented, and optimal funding management strategies that we employed at the site. So slide number 25. The Emerald Septic Landfill site is a 38-acre former septic waste and landfill sludge disposal facility. It's located in a rural area of Atlantic County. And actually, if you flip to slide number 26, you'll see a photograph of the site. The site itself is highlighted in yellow outline, and it's right near Stockton College, and the Garden State Parkway is that highway running north-south on the right-hand side of the figure. But basically, waste was disposed of at the site from 1967 to 1979. Septic waste and sewage sludge were disposed of in trenches and lagoons on the site, and chemical waste, paint sludges, and household garbage were also disposed of at the site. Prior to CDM starting the remedial investigation, the EPA removal branch removed approximately 300 drums from the site, and some of the contaminated soils were also removed. So when CDM began at the facility, we started with a focused feasibility study because, as you can see from the photograph, it's a large area, and this area wasn't originally serviced by town water. So everyone was on private wells and septic systems. So groundwater contamination was a very big problem at this site, and we needed to address it quickly. So we did a groundwater-focused feasibility study to conduct, to basically determine for the shallow aquifer how far the plume had traveled from the site and if it was impacting the residents. The EPA removal branch had done some sampling at the residents prior to us coming on site, and they did identify a few locations where the private wells were contaminated, and they drilled deeper wells for them. Then we moved into the remedial investigation, where we focused on delineating the deep aquifer plume and also surface and subsurface soil on site. And then we had a supplemental RI where we were looking for NAPL contamination on site, and then further refinement of the deep aquifer plume. We hadn't quite found the end of it during the RI investigation, so we were still trying to track down the end of it. But basically, groundwater flow from the site is from east to west toward the Garden State Parkway. There are two aquifers that we were mainly dealing with at the site. It was a shallow plume. Depth to groundwater was about 20 to 25 feet below ground surface. There was a low permeability unit that really didn't exist at the site and thickened as it went toward the Garden State Parkway toward the east. So contaminants flowed directly down from the site into the both shallow and deep aquifer and kind of straddled both of them. So we were tracking both plumes. The shallow plume, by the end of the investigation, we had determined had traveled about a half a mile from the facility, where the deep plume had traveled over a mile from the site. So it actually went beyond the Garden State Parkway. So if you turn to slide number 27, primary contaminants at the site were TCE, cis-12-DC, and vinyl chloride in groundwater. We did observe some natural attenuation at the site, but it was getting stuck at vinyl chloride. The site itself was placed on the National Priorities List in July of 1999. The EPA is the fund lead at the site, so we're working directly with EPA Region 2 with this. And CDM completed the RISS under the EPA Region 2 Response Action Contract. And the project was incrementally funded. And if you turn to slide number 28, definition of incremental funding, for those not familiar with it, is incremental allocation of funds based on the project scope, fund usage rate or a burn rate, and a schedule. So if you're talking about a $2 million investigation, you might get chunks of funding from $300,000 to $500,000 at a time. So what you really need to do is work very closely with your client to understand the to make sure they understand the minimum amount of funding that's needed and what can be accomplished with those funds. So when you're talking about a triad approach where you're looking at potentially a large scope of work, what we had to do with EPA Region 2 was really define what it was that we wanted to do very clearly in the work plan. And we didn't have as much flexibility, although we did make it as flexible as we could. We basically had to kind of lay out the maximum that we would do and then kind of were able to cut back as we went. So some of the challenges that we faced, we needed to make a flexible work plan to address dynamic strategy of the field screening, but we also needed to provide enough information to appropriately cost out all of the different elements of the investigation. We needed to set up a communication plan to inform EPA when funds would be required for each stage of the work, and the flexibility to accommodate field changes and associated additional funding requests. We also needed to keep within existing project funding limits. So each time they gave us an incremental funding, that became our new expenditure limit, so we could never exceed that. So slide number 30. We implemented three different triad investigations at the site. Basically, during each phase of the operation, the FFS, the RI, and the supplemental, there was one element of it that was triad-like investigation. And typically, Region 2 doesn't use the word triad, but it did have all of the elements of the triad approach: systematic planning, a dynamic work strategies, and real-time measurements. For the first element, during the FFS, we did groundwater screening in the shallow aquifer, which was combined with an on-site laboratory so that we could get quick results for volatile organic compounds so that we could make decisions in the field which screening points that we wanted to continue doing. We also did a membrane interface probe screening during the NAPL investigation to try and identify additional source areas that could be on the site. And groundwater screening in the deep aquifer was performed using geoprobe and hydropunch to define the vertical and horizontal extent of the deep groundwater and establish screening intervals for the monitoring wells. Because during our first investigation, we just kind of looked at putting the monitoring wells just below the clay, and we sometimes hit and sometimes missed the plume. So to get a little bit more precise as the investigation went on during the supplemental RI, we employed this screening technology in the deep aquifer to better set our monitoring wells to find the contamination. So what I'm going to go, we're going to turn to slide 31, and then I'm going to give you a little bit of an investigation summary and results for each of the three different investigations that we performed. So groundwater screening in the shallow aquifer, we plan 60 locations, screening every 10 feet from the water table to 80 feet below ground surface. And that's about where we would find that clay layer if it existed, somewhere between 70 and 80 feet. And our water table was about 20 to 30 feet below ground surface. We identified sampling locations ahead of time because, as you saw from the site, the investigation was going to go in the shallow aquifer from the site to about the Garden State Parkway. All of those properties are individually owned. Even the area that looks undeveloped is actually parceled out, and a number of those parcels are already sold off. They were planning to do a development in that area. So we really needed to understand where we were going to put these screening points and get the appropriate access in place before we started. We implemented screening in accordance with a dynamic strategy, and we requested funding to cover the full investigation, so we knew we could do all 60 points and get through the entire investigation without having to come to a stopping point and ask for more funding. We held daily calls with EPA to discuss results and future locations to be investigated. And during this investigation, we employed 2 drill rigs, so we were able to get somewhere between 2 and 3 borings done a day with the sample, which satisfied the quota to kind of keep an on-site laboratory busy full-time while we were there. Results, if you turn to slide 32, we determined the plume boundary in the shallow aquifer was actually 24 screening points, so it wasn't quite as far as we initially had thought it was in the shallow aquifer. We supported target placement of permanent monitoring wells in the shallow aquifer, and we were also able to complete our field investigation 3 weeks ahead of schedule, and we were also able to manage our property access issues to limit impact on the program. So as we found pockets of contamination and we were chasing the plume, sometimes we would need to adjust where borings were going to be done. So we needed to work with property owners and sometimes get access to those locations very quickly so that we could continue drilling and collecting our samples. So the successes that we had in the shallow aquifer screening program were that we were able to implement the triad approach within the contract requirements and funding structure. We were able to use the remaining screening funds to continue the field investigation, so the money never went to waste. We could just continue on and do additional investigations before we needed to ask for more funding. We executed a communication plan and able to keep EPA informed on progress, results, and field decisions, including our stakeholders, and we communicated property access agreements critical to the program in a timely fashion to EPA, so it never really slowed us down. But a big portion of the groundwater screening was all about communication and making sure everyone was aware of what we were doing and the decisions that we were making. So on slide 34, the MIP investigation, we plan to screen 47 locations in the source area from the surface to 80 feet below ground surface. And the source area primarily composed of the site itself, so we didn't have as many access issues with this investigation. We were able to complete 37 locations as planned, and we added 3 new locations to further define specific areas where we had high MIP hits. We wanted to get a little bit more of a definition if we were actually hitting some contaminants or NAPL, or if we were, you know, just kind of chasing something and needed to define the boundaries. We did have a weather delay. We did start this investigation in January, and the MIP doesn't function as well in the colder weather. So we actually ended up having to shut down and came back in the spring to finish up the investigation. We coordinated with EPA and other stakeholders regularly and made field decisions as a team. Slide number 35. One of the challenges we had during the MIP investigation was we were supposed to submit a formal review and tech memo after screening because it delayed our Phase 2 field investigation. And one of the solutions we came up with to minimize the formal interim report, we actually proposed meetings and presented the results by submitting the MIP results sheets that we received from our subcontractor, and we were able to use our meeting minutes to document our decisions. So we kind of cut down on the formal technical memo that we needed to submit. This has established a more interactive approach, a little bit more triad-like throughout the project. So slide number 36, our deep groundwater screening investigation. We initially planned 9 locations to be completed at the tail end of our deep aquifer plume to define the end of it. We had proposed using a geoprobe drill rig to do this, screening at 10-foot intervals from 80 feet to about 150 feet below ground surface, and that was getting through the confining layer at that point, because as we went toward the tail end of the plume, there actually was a confining unit between the shallow and deep aquifer. And then we sent groundwater samples for VOC analysis off-site to a laboratory for 24-hour turnaround so we could get quick data back to make decisions on where monitoring wells were going to be set. And we proposed frequent meetings with EPA and stakeholders to discuss results and plan the next screening points. And this ended up being 2 to 3 days a week, like every other day or so, when we had enough results back to be able to discuss and make decisions.
This is just a reminder from Jean. If you have yourself on a phone line, if you could mute your line. If you don't have a mute button, hit *6 to mute your line. We're picking up some background noise, and we are getting a couple complaints from some people. So again, *6 to mute, and if you're one of the speakers and you're holding a headset, try to minimize any movement you might be making with that phone, because that might be the noise that we're hearing. Thank you.
Okay. Now I'm confused. All right, slide number 37, our funding challenges for the deep aquifer. The geoprobe was not able to reach our proposed depth. It was actually limited to about 125 feet under site conditions. So we needed to change our drilling technique and use a hydro punch with mud rotary drilling to reach the total depth. And this also requires the installations of casings into the low permeability layer, which we had gotten permission from New Jersey DEP not to do with the groundwater, with the geoprobe method, because it was punching such a small hole, and we were taking a soil sample before we went through to make sure there was no napple sitting on that clay before we went through it. So they were okay with that method, but when we switched over to the mud rotary and hydro punch method, we needed to install casings. These costs were not included in our budget. Although we identified the potential for this method if the geoprobe failed, so in our work plan we had detailed this additional method, we just hadn't included the cost. So when we received incremental funding from EPA, it didn't cover switching drill methods. So that was our challenge that we needed to deal with in the deep aquifer investigation. So slide number 38. The solution that we came up with to handle this challenge was we completed the screening to a maximum depth the geoprobe could get to, and with that we were able to define the horizontal extent of the plume. So we were able to see how far the plume had traveled, or at least where it had dipped below the capability of the geoprobe, because with a TCE plume it was actually sinking as it traveled away from the site. So as we went farther out from the site, we had to find it at deeper depths. So once we stopped seeing contaminants in the first or second sample, or the bottom samples that we could get to with the geoprobe, we actually stopped using that method. But while we continued on with the geoprobe, we provided EPA with a justification for new drilling methods and associated cost increase, and modified our drilling subcontract to include this new method. And then we successfully completed the investigation using the new drilling and sampling method. So slide number 39, the lessons that we learned during the deep aquifer screening was we maintained communication with EPA, and because we notified EPA early about the drilling method shortcoming and immediately began work on the alternative method, we minimized our downtime to less than 1 month while we were getting new funds for the site and switching our methods and getting all of our documentation back in place. We clearly identified contingencies in the work plan, and we addressed the impacts of the contingencies on funding relatively quickly as we went through this process. So optimal funding management strategies we employed at the site, or the conclusions on slide 40, successful implementation of the triad approach with limited and incremental funding requires detailed planning. So make sure your work plans include potential options if your methods may not succeed. If you have the backup options detailed in your work plan, you may have some more flexibility when you get to the site to kind of fall back on something else. Clear statements of goals and contingencies, as well as frequent and effective communication with EPA's technical and management personnel and other stakeholders throughout the activity. So these are the key elements that were needed to support successful triad investigations for the Alma Septic landfill site. Some of the resources that if you have questions beyond the seminar that you could contact are Joe Gowers, who's the EPA Remedial Project Manager. They are currently working on the remedial action for the shallow groundwater plume. They're in the process of building the pump and treat site structure at this point. I can be contacted, and also the CERCLA's website has information about the Emerald Septic Landfill site. So I guess at this time I can answer questions.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Sharon. If you're on the phone lines, you're welcome to take your line off of mute. You can hit #6 to do that and ask a question out loud.
I see one question on the that came in. How are the items submitted? And I'm guessing that how we were transferring the documents back and forth to our client, EPA, and other stakeholders, most of that was done. We were summarizing data in tables and sending off figures and tables via email to our client prior to daily or every other day phone calls.
Okay. There were some people in the room who were discussing, we've seen in some other triad projects where they sort of create an information repository of some place where that data is uploaded or people know to go to look. So we weren't sure if there was a website or something else, or if it was just your standard email on a daily, weekly basis.
We had done these a few years ago, so at that time, most of it was done via email. I know some of the subcontractors that we worked with out at the site now have the ability to set up these websites where you can go in and retrieve data on a daily basis, and they kind of continue to help create your site conceptual model as you go through, and as you collect more MIPS investigation or more groundwater data, they can also provide that modeling as you go through the project.
There was also another question in the room with me where people were wondering if this was identified as triad when you were talking with EPA Region 2, or you identified this as good practice and this is what we want to do.
It was more a good practice. We never have used the term triad on the project, but it does, take into account all of the elements of triad. And so it is, when you look back at it, it's a triad approach, but it's not called that, and it's typically not used in our region. At least on the projects that I've been involved with that we've used this type of approach, we don't reference it as a triad approach.
Okay, great. For those of you who are streaming the audio online, again, a reminder, if you do have a question, you can use that small question mark icon, the orange circle on top of your screen. Turn off your pop-up blockers, and you can type up any comments or questions you may have. Those of you on the phone lines, you're welcome to go ahead and speak up and just ask your questions out loud if you have any. Well, Nick, do you have any closing comments based off of Sharon's presentation? If you're still on the line, Nick, did we lose you? If you muted your line, it's #6 to unmute your phone line. Well, it seems we may have lost our first speaker, Nick Negro, which is a shame. But Sharon, you're still here with me, correct?
Yes.
Okay, great. I'm going to stay on the line for a minute or two more, but I just wanted to thank you and Nick as well for the presentation today. If I could direct everyone to the final slide number 42. If you are typing up your questions or have a last-minute comment, go ahead. We'll still be on the line here for about another minute or so. But on slide number 42, we have two important links. The first one is a link to additional resources, which you will, if you follow that, you'll be able to download today's seminar in its completion, as well as follow a few other links to relevant resources, for example, the Triad Resource Center, where you can find a great wealth of information, documents, fact sheets, links, templates that you can download, examples of other Triad projects if you'd like to learn more about this methodology. There's also the opportunity to learn more about the Triad Community of Practice, which is one of the groups that helped sponsor the Triad National Conference and Training Session last year, which is where this talk was originally delivered. The second link on slide number 42 is our feedback form. If you are participating today, we ask that you take a minute or two when we're done and follow that link, where you'll just simply let us know how we did, how the quality came through in terms of participating audibly as well as online. If you like the content, if you'd like to see more talks like this, we do read each one of those forms individually, and we do use your feedback to help maintain the service and continue to improve future deliveries. So one last call for any final comments or questions on the phone line.
Yes, hi. How do you make those links active? Because they're not active on the one I'm looking at.
They're not active on the one you're looking at. Did you download the slides?
Yeah, I'm looking at, I downloaded the slides in PowerPoint.
Okay, it's possible that the hyperlink didn't come through in the actual downloaded version of it. I apologize. If you go to the seminar homepage, if you have that original email that confirmed it on the seminar homepage, you'll find those very same links at the very bottom of the page describing it.
Very good.
And then those links will be, for everyone who's on the line, will be available forever, so that page will always exist. When we archive it, you can come back to the same page and replay, and if you send the link to a colleague and they watch it after the live delivery, they can also submit feedback for the event as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, then with that, I don't hear any other questions or see anything else coming in online. Again, I just wanted to thank our speakers today, Nick Negro from ECCS, or pardon me, my acronym is too many things here in the government alphabet soup, pardon me, and Sharon Budney from CDM. I also would like to thank all of the participants today who joined us both on the phone lines as well as the streaming audio. This was session number 5 in a 5-part seminar series. This is focusing on the Triad approach here on Kluwen, where again today we looked at the Triad community of practice, or pardon me, the Triad implementation approach. The very next seminar series is going to be Triad month session number 6, where we're going to actually look at Triad case studies. And that has been scheduled for August 20th. Let me see if I can pull the time up, from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. So if you're interested in participating in that seminar, again, it's going to be August 20th from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We still have a few spots available. You can go to kluwen.org/training and sign up for that session. Also, again, I'd encourage you to take a look at the additional resources we have available, learn more about the Triad Community of Practice, as well as the Triad Resource Center. Those links are on the additional resources page. And if you liked this session and found it valuable, I would encourage you to sign up for our archive training email notification or a podcast on kluwen.org/training, where you'll be able to send the recording of this session to any colleagues or coworkers that you think might find it of use. So thank you, everyone, for your time today, and I hope to see you again soon on another Kluwen Internet Seminar. Have a good day.